On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to answer these questions. How big is the gap between the Eastern Conference and the Western Conference? And LeBron, can he make his way to the Cleveland Cavaliers one more time? Mike Brown, speaking of LeBron, Mike Brown is not taking the Cleveland job. He's taking the Knicks job. What does that mean for the New York Knickerbockers going forward? And Miles Turner, now with the Milwaukee Bucks, but is that much of an upgrade for Giannis Antetokounmpo and their squad? All this coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's The Big Number. I'm Tom Haberstroh, and that's Dan Devine. We do this every week here at Yahoo Sports, and the jaw is being picked up off the floor after what we saw during free agency and the draft night. All of this stuff is coming to a head this episode. Dan, how are you? Is your jaw okay? Is your chin okay? Did you need stitches?
No stitches, no reconstructive surgery, jaw intact. It took a little while to get it back up there after Yang Hansen, but it's here now. It's back together. And we got through the draft. We got to the beginning of free agency. We are in July. We are recording this just after noon Eastern time on Wednesday, July 2nd. And it's time, Tom Haberstroh, for us to put up some numbers. So hit me with it. What is this week's big number, free agency edition?
This week's big number, Dan, is 1,318, as in the Eastern Conference could win their next 1,318 games against the Western Conference, and they would still have a worse record than the West since 2000. 1,318. So that's three seasons worth, basically, because every year we have like 450 East versus West games, interleague games. So you could go three seasons in a row of not losing a single game, and they would still be under 500 against the West since 2000. That is courtesy of Basketball Reference. And you might be wondering, the folks at home listening to this, watching this on YouTube, why are we talking about this? Why is this relevant? Well, I think we need to point this out because of what just happened in the NBA. You've got a not just a triple crown, I would say a grand slam. The West swept. Is that even a word, Dan? Swept. I haven't been getting a lot of sleep lately.
It's all right. Listen, it's this time of year. We're all cranked up to the gills on our MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference coffee mugs. We're jacked to the gills. We're not getting sleep. Sweep me with it, Tom. Hit me.
The sweep of the grand slam here is you got the regular season was won by the West. The finals was won by the West. The draft lottery was won by a Western Conference team. Cooper Flagg go to the Dallas Mavericks. And then, of course, I would argue, and we'll talk about this, free agency was won by the Western Conference. Then you go to the Milwaukee Bucks that is trying to win the East with waiving Damian Lillard and stretching his contract. We'll get into that later. And signing Miles Turner with one of the most shocking moves I've seen since covering the sport, that Damian Lillard is a free agent for the next 5 years. His cap number is going to be flattened over on the Milwaukee Bucks, and he can pick his team. Just a couple years ago, he was the missing piece for the Milwaukee Bucks, and now they've already waived him. So they're going for it, because also you see in the East, the Indiana Pacers, they let Miles Turner walk to the Milwaukee Bucks after Tyrese Haliburton tore his Achilles. And the Boston Celtics are shedding salary and kind of reloading after Jason Tatum tore his Achilles in the NBA playoffs. So you have the Western Conference looking at this and being like, all right, we're going to ramp up. Like the East is going to be a lot less this upcoming season. So what did Denver do? They traded for Cam Johnson, sending Michael Porter Jr. over to Brooklyn. Not only did they take Cam Johnson from the East, they also took Tim Hardaway Jr. And Bruce Brown, also coming back to the champs, to the champion team from a few years back. But the Western Conference, man, they have continued to dominate the East. And I think it's worth talking about how loaded the Western Conference already got with free agency. If you look at BetMGM right now, okay, the top three title favorites, Dad, are OKC, Denver, and Houston. Three teams from the same. We never see this. The last time this has happened is 2008. It's been that long since we've seen three teams at the top from the same conference. And so Vegas is looking at this like, I just don't see a way for the Eastern Conference to supersede what we're seeing from Denver and Houston and OKC. Good luck, Eastern Conference. So I wrote about this at Yahoo Sports, and I just think we should talk about, is there a way, is there a path for one of these teams, whether it's the Knicks, whether it's Cleveland? I have an idea that I want to throw at you, just kind of drop it. I wrote this in the column. LeBron to the Cavs. I think this is what this is all about. we're recording this around lunchtime on Wednesday, so maybe the news will come out and this will look obsolete. But I feel like low-key, LeBron has been planning his return to the Cavs and trying to force his way there because he probably got word that the Lakers are kind of punting this offseason. They let DFS, Dorian Finney-Smith, go to the Houston Rockets, a rival team in the Western Conference, number two seed, and just added one of the great wing defenders from the Lakers. And I kind of feel like he got a whiff of this and was trying to get out in front of it. And now, look, Darius Garland, hurt with the turf toe injury, that he's not going to be ready for next season, maybe at the start of next season. Dan, is that crazy? Am I out of my mind by suggesting that the Eastern Conference is so weak that LeBron James could be looking at this like, I went to the finals 8 straight times. I know how weak it is. I'm going back. Cleveland, bring me home.
I don't think it's crazy. I think for the starting point is that basically it has felt like the clock on LeBron's time in LA began ticking louder and louder the second they traded for Luka Doncic, right? Like the 14-year spread between Luka's age and LeBron's age. It was like very clearly, this is where we are prioritizing our, the forward-looking outlook for our franchise is going to be built around what Luka can be over the next decade and a half, not what LeBron is, and like what makes the most sense for him in the next year or two. That dovetails with what we've seen, like the reporting, I think Dave McMenamin at ESPN, that like they're looking to not add anything beyond 2 years because they want to be able to maximize their financial flexibility, 2027 and beyond. Setting aside whether that's like a good idea for your...
You got Luka and LeBron on your team. Come on.
Like, yeah, right. Like,
you have Dorian Finney-Smith. You just add a center to this. Wow. 2 years from now is a long time in the NBA, as we just saw with Damian Lillard. Go ahead.
Sorry. Absolutely. But I mean, I guess if you're looking at it and saying, like, is there a version of this that's, it's Garland and, we know that the Cavs are, or the Lakers are looking for a center. And it's like, well, Jared Allen is like a screen and dive lob catching big man who seems like he would work real well with Luka Doncic and like the rim protector behind those perimeter guys. Or, I am not nimble enough on the trade machines as we are recording right now to find the right financial mix. But if there's something that's like, Garland and Allen, or like a DeAndre Hunter gets into the mix there as well. Like there might be a framework. I'm guessing based on your wonderful faces, I'm guessing that you've got something worked out here already.
I do. There's a few cap gurus in our space that I would trust with figuring out all of the bells and whistles that would have to go into this trade to make it legal under the CBA. Eric Pincus from BR is one of them. Sure. And he wrote about this framework. And I wasn't sure about the second apron rules and how that would affect things. But this is a trade, a 4-team trade. You loop in the Houston Rockets.
Yeah, I had no shot. I had no chance of putting this together on the fly. Okay, let's hear it.
No chance. I frankly, it is so beyond, like, unless you've been studying the cap minutiae for the last like 15 years, I don't think this would really make sense to you in your head. But I trust him. And I think this framework does make some sense. Okay. I made a couple tweaks to it, but basically this is what it is. LeBron James to the Cleveland Cavaliers along with Bronny. Okay.
Sure.
Cleveland sends Darius Garland not to LA or Houston, but to Utah. Utah gets their point guard of the future. And yes, he's got the toe injury that he's not probably going to be 100% for the start of next season. But Utah, I don't think really cares. They care about getting a 25-year-old stud, all-star, all-NBA caliber point guard, right? But it's going to cost them Walker Kessler going to the Cavs.
Sure.
So they're going to get Darius Garland. And Walker Kessler is going back to Cleveland. So LeBron, Walker Kessler going to Cleveland. Houston gets Finney Smith. They were already getting Finney Smith. And so they're going to get a sign and trade using Dorian Finney Smith. But the Lakers on the other side are going to get Jared Allen, like you pointed out, and DeAndre Hunter. Okay. So I wrote about this a couple months ago, which is like when the Lakers were bounced from the playoffs, I was like, man, Jared Allen, he would look really good next to Luka Doncic as a rim protector, as a vertical spacer. It's hard to find many bigs, young bigs that fit the timeline of Luka Doncic and check those boxes better than Jared Allen. And guess what? It becomes a lot more likely now that if they were have an early exit in the postseason, that I feel like would be the only reason why Cleveland would entertain such a deal, and they had an early exit from the postseason. So 14 trade, LeBron to Cleveland, along with Bronny, and Walker Kessler goes to Cleveland. Then from the Utah side, they get their all-star. They get their point guard of the future next to Ace Bailey and Lauri Markkanen. And the rest of their rotation is set with their future point guard. And from the Cleveland side, it makes sense because also you're getting off long-term money. Like LeBron could feasibly retire next year. If he's traded to Cleveland, you know that there's going to be like this talk about a retirement farewell tour, and would be a really nice heartfelt story. But also it makes sense from an organizational standpoint if you're trying to duck the tax or try to not have such a crazy tax bill. So that's the trade that I proposed in the piece. And I feel like the fact that the Lakers haven't announced LeBron James's return, it feels like something's cooking. I don't know what it is. Third eye is open on this, Dan. You're absolutely right. So what do you think? What do you think about that framework?
First blush, I just think about what's left in Cleveland, right? And then you've got, so Donovan Mitchell moves on to the point, and it's Mitchell Mobley at the five, LeBron at the four. You fit in, like, is it Max Strus in the mix there? You know, is Dean Wade picking up more minutes? You know, Larry Nance Jr. just comes back and he's like kind of a combo big. But like you're building out from LeBron, Mobley, Mitchell. It's a pretty strong place to start. And when you think about Walker Kessler also. I forgot about his. So yeah, then you're like, you're still huge up front. You have LeBron can go, you know, play the three, slide up to the four. He can be the like back to the basket, you know, mash you in the post, bully you, that they don't really have to be able to slow down and play a different style if they need to. And you still have, you know, Mitchell able to handle most of the ball handling, and may also some of the off ball strides he made last year as a floor spacer, you know, creating more opportunities for other guys to create. I don't hate it. I think that there's still plenty of depth there. Like I said, you bring back, you know, Larry Nance, you've got Dean Wade there, you've got Sam Merrill there, you know, as another shooter off the bench, guys that can space the floor for LeBron or for Mitchell. Makes some sense there. In the Lakers, you reorient more fully around Luka's timeline. It's a little bit of a tough pill, maybe a bitter pill to swallow for Darius Garland, rather. He winds up, you know, going to Utah and being at the start of a rebuild as opposed to, you know, right on the cusp of championship contention. But I like the idea.
It's his team.
It's his team. Send it in, Tom. I like the idea. I also love this idea that, like, if you're talking about what has LeBron's Los Angeles tenure largely been about, it's like he's there for the storytelling elements of his life outside the court, right? Where it's like, I have my, you know, the Spring Hill production studio here, and we're going to increase my footprint in movies and in television, whatever. What better storytelling avenue than it's like, well, now let's come up with the final chapter of my NBA story by bringing it back to Cleveland with my son as we look to sort of close the book here and then move into whatever's next. There's a lot to like. I imagine not so much for the rest of the teams in the league that are like, come on, man. Like, now we're making 3 to 4 teams better here and then giving, you know, creating or bolstering multiple championship contenders. I don't know about that. But yeah, like LeBron he spent an awful long time saying the path of least resistance to a championship is in the Eastern Conference. Given the state of the Western Conference as it looks right now, it would make an awful lot of sense to look at to make the same evaluation and, you know, come East, old man, I guess not young man anymore.
Oh, you know what? My final line in the piece is, if the league's eldest player wants to win a championship while he's still at an all-NBA level, it's clear that the loaded Western Conference is no country for old men.
There you go. I mean, right? Listen, I don't know if it's just an indication that we have been talking to each other too much over the course of the last, you know, 6 to 8 months. If it's just like, this is the way washed writers think, where we're like, what's the kicker on this one? But yes, we've
gone for a Coen Brothers reference here and just land this plane. Yeah.
That's exactly right. And then get out. It's a higher level kicker than like, it remains to be seen, or it will be interesting to watch what comes next. Whatever gets you out of the piece.
Time will tell.
Yeah, time will tell. Right. When in doubt, just get out of there. I love that. I think it's interesting. I think it would be a potential balance shifter, maybe not 1,318 wins worth of a balance shifter.
But that's why LeBron is, I feel like LeBron wants to get out of the Western Conference, because he's been to the NBA Finals once with the Lakers in what is 7 seasons, and he went 8 straight seasons of going to the Finals with the Cavs and the Heat. So I just think from a storytelling standpoint, from a roster standpoint, from the cap standpoint, this makes sense for a lot of the teams. And of course, you can throw first round picks and protections around and sweeten here and there, but you know, at free agency, the East is, I think, getting a big downgrade this offseason. And the West is loading up. And there's some really interesting numbers in the piece, and I encourage you to read it. But basically, the West added +5 in the estimated wins added department over at dunksandthrees.com. They were +5 in aggregate of all the players that moved from the East to the West. And on the other side,
they got to come from somewhere.
The Western Conference teams that went east, or Western Conference players that went east and swapped conferences this offseason, their aggregate rating is -15. Okay. So it's just classic that the West keeps getting richer. And that's why I think LeBron James is eyeing a return to Cleveland for his third stint and final one. Putting it on the board. Let's see if it happens. So how does the East balance this out even more? We're going to check in with your four little numbers, your best candidates to kind of maybe get to, you know, knock that down from 1,318 to like 1,000 flat next season. Coming up. All right, Dan, this week's big number again, 1,318. That is the number of consecutive wins that the Eastern Conference could have against the Western Conference in head-to-head matchups. And they would still have a losing record since 2000. 23 of the last 26 seasons, the West has beaten the East in the regular season. It's just comical. Comical. 17 out of the last 26 champions, I think, is something like that, is from the West. So how does the East fight back? They don't want to be known as the Eastern Conference anymore. Dan, who's your first candidate to punch back against OKC and the rest of the West?
All right. Well, our first little number is it's the team that we just discussed, but absent the context of a LeBron James return, +9.3. That's how many points per 100 possessions better the Bulls were last season when Lonzo Ball was on the floor than when he was off it. That's on-off swing, according to our friends at Cleaning the Glass. So they played about more than 6,500 possessions without Lonzo last season. The Bulls got outscored by 3.3 points per 100. That's like it's a bottom 10 net rating, around what the Suns did during their disappointing season last year, which, when, again, everybody got fired and traded. In just under 1,800 possessions with Lonzo on the court, +6 per 100 for the Bulls, which would have been better than like the Knicks, the Wolves, and the Rockets in terms of their full season net rating. Now, obviously, you know, small sample size theater, you can't apply like one thing to a full season. But the general point is, without Lonzo, Bulls stunk. With Lonzo, they played really well. Lonzo Ball, as you might have heard, no longer on the Bulls. Now a member of the Cleveland Cavaliers, thanks to a trade that sent Isaac Okoro to Chicago and brought Lonzo to Cleveland.
Surely there's some picks involved, right?
You know, you'd think so, but the Bulls, actually, it would be like insulting to them to even submit that they should be getting a pick in any of these trades. They didn't take one for Alex Caruso and get Josh Giddey back. They certainly weren't going to take one for Lonzo Ball and get back Isaac Okoro. They're just really excited about building with young vets. You know, lots of love to them and all the more power to them. Lonzo Ball, the obvious red flag is his health. Missed 2 full seasons with knee issues and had a like revolutionary, you know, cartilage replacement, you know, surgery to transplant a new kneecap, I believe, onto his knee. And it took a while to get him back on the court. He got on the court last year, played only 35 games, 777 minutes. And I think there was a wrist issue that was, you know, plaguing him later in the season as well. Big if, though, if he's healthy, 6'6 wing, can shoot the ball, passes the hell out of it, great defensive player, phenomenal instincts, great hands, blocks and steal rates, etc. How much, even without LeBron, how much does just adding Lonzo into the mix of what was already there in Cleveland elevate that Cavs team in the context of a West that's super strong and an East that's kind of waning?
I love this pickup for Cleveland, regardless of LeBron. I think it even gets better if LeBron is there, just because Lonzo Ball doesn't have to do as much if LeBron is there in terms of the heavy lifting. Donovan Mitchell, not a great defender. Lonzo Ball, much better defender than Ty Jerome. Ty Jerome last year felt like he was in some ways like Josh Giddey, played off the floor in the postseason, not as potent as he was in the regular season. I love Ty Jerome. Regular season was just a baller. Like bucket getter, some of the best highlights of last season involved Ty Jerome just doing crazy things. And in the postseason, it just kind of got neutralized in ways that I think they were not okay to let him walk and go to Memphis. One of many players that went from East to West, as I noted at the top. But this trade, it's just great work. I mean, you already have DeAndre Hunter on the team. So Isaac Okoro becomes a little bit superfluous, and you bring in someone who is perfect in that Kenny Atkinson system. And I just think, like, when you already are trying to figure out how to get a little bit bigger in the backcourt, you get one of the best big ball handlers in the league in Lonzo Ball. And certainly this is an injury question mark, but I love what Cleveland did here. And there's only been four trades in the last 2 years that involved guys getting traded straight up. And the Chicago Bulls are involved in two of them. Like you mentioned, Alex Caruso for Josh Giddey last year, and then here Isaac Okoro for Lonzo Ball. The Bulls just love these types of trades, and I can't believe that they were that willing to sell high on Lonzo Ball without getting more in return. But Cleveland, great work from Kobe Altman, and Kenny Atkinson is going to be really happy to have Lonzo Ball on the team. And with LeBron, I just think you want high IQ players on the floor that are skilled, super talented, good shooter, great instincts, like you said. I think that is a really sneaky, great pickup for the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Yeah, the dice roll here is looking for the upside outcome like the Celtics got with Derek White or the Thunder got with Alex Caruso, where this like super fast processor can defend multiple positions, contributes a lot without needing to dominate the ball, can shoot like... Isaac Okoro, you mentioned Josh Giddey getting played off the floor. Isaac Okoro has run into those same problems for Cleveland the last couple of postseasons. It gives you the opportunity to have a player who elevates and connects without being played off the floor in a postseason context. So I think the goal would be manage his minutes in the same way that Oklahoma City did with Caruso all season, like sit him out of back-to-backs, keep whatever, and then like manage him to get to the postseason and then hope for that you can get that same kind of impact. So it's a dice roll. It's a pretty small needle to thread, but similar to you, I like the idea of a Cavaliers team that was already 23-7 against the West last year, putting itself in position to, you know, increase its margin of error and maybe even become a stronger contender there. Our second little number this week is 6. That's how many members of the Knicks averaged 17 or more minutes per game against the West last season. So not even half the game, not even 20 minutes a game, 17 minutes a game. I'm going to guess you can name all 6 members of the Knicks, but I won't put you on the spot. It's Mikal Bridges, Josh Hart, OG Anunoby, Jalen Brunson, Karl-Anthony Towns, and Deuce McBride, a.k.a. the starters and the one other guy Tom Thibodeau trusted on the New York Knicks last season. Pretty much par for the course, and, you know, there's a number of reasons why. Tibbs loved that starting five, whether he should have or shouldn't have, or the numbers bored out, who knows. Mitchell Robinson was injured for a lot of last season, missed more than, you know, the bulk of the season coming back from ankle surgery. A lot of skepticism, fair or unfair, about what those veterans, guys like Campaign, Landry Shamet, DeLon Wright could provide. And, you know, you're not going to lean too hard on rookies like Tyler Kolek, Ariel Hukporti, or Pacome Dadier. So that's 6 guys who, when they faced the West, got more than 17 minutes a game. This season, though, or heading into next season, rather, you got Mitchell Robinson healthy. you got a pair of new free agent arrivals, Jordan Clarkson, one of those West to East guys, and Gershon Yabusele. They grabbed him from the 76ers. A nice pickup with the taxpayer mid-level exception, I believe that is what they wound up giving him. And if I'm adding right here, that's a nine-man rotation, which I don't think the Knicks have had, I don't know, since before the pandemic. And if that's before you get into even into any like growth from the young guys or if they bring back Shamet or whatever, you know. So what we do have, though, is a Knicks team that with maybe some fresh ideas and some fresh bodies can maybe help narrow that gap between East and West a little bit. What do you think about the way the Knicks are coming out of the first couple of days of free agency and looking to head into next season?
Well, I think also the Knicks, not only do they have a good team that could make a sizable jump next season, a couple things have to go their way for them to do that internally, like organically, but they're also in position to go after LeBron if he decides, I want to be traded and I want to go to Madison Square Garden. We saw last year
at
the deadline.
It's Lucy in the football, though, man. It's Lucy in the football. It's like, how many times in my life can I hear about how LeBron James is coming to the friggin' Garden? Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead. At the deadline.
Well, he at the deadline last year tweeted out an hourglass emoji. Then he wore these orange and blue Knicks colored kicks at while walking up the ramp and saying, Mr. James back in the garden, Mr. James at the garden. And then after the game, of course, in the post game press conference on ESPN, he made sure that he had a Knicks towel draped over his shoulders. It's just classic. But, you know, they have the ammo and also happening at the deadline last year, that whole like, Clutch Sports, Rich Paul meeting, clandestine meeting with Leon Rose and the Knicks front office. Apparently, they had kind of a fractured relationship at the Knicks, weren't really signing any clutch players. And if they did, it didn't end well with Cam Reddish being, I think, the one that was kind of the example there. Now we're seeing Jordan Clarkson going over to the Knicks, a clutch client going to the Knicks and signing there. The fruits of that labor, you know, coming out of that meeting, you know, Jordan Clarkson is the guy, right? But maybe the real guy is LeBron. You know, like LeBron has always flirted with this idea and teased us and trolled us about the Knicks. If they don't get LeBron or if LeBron is actually going to stay with the Lakers, the Knicks could also be like, hey, Giannis, you happy with having Kevin Porter Jr. and Gary Trent as being basically your backcourt there? Come on down. Come over to New York. So, like, they're in position. Also, on that front, the Milwaukee Bucks have no incentive to tank because they don't have their picks. So, like, a guy like Karl-Anthony Towns, it makes sense if they're going to try to reload and retool. They're not going to want to just get flotsam and a bunch of picks. They're going to want a guy who can play right away. And, you know, Karl-Anthony Towns could be that guy. So, like, organically, the Knicks make a lot of sense of moving up in the pecking order in the East. But also, they could take another big swing here.
I wrote in December of 2018, when I was working at The Ringer, a story about all the times LeBron has flirted with, mentioned, discussed the opportunity to potentially come to New York. It goes back to like wearing a Yankees hat to the ALCS in 2007. Yes. So like,
Which bothered me. I remember that.
But it's
as a
literally
Red Sox fan, yeah.
Like, there are prospects being drafted younger than the will LeBron come to New York storyline. Like, it's preposterous, but here we are. What is preposterous, perhaps most preposterous about it, is that it's not preposterous. Like, you could actually see an argument for why he would make sense as like the finishing piece.
We're through the looking glass now in the NBA. With like, right. Damian Lillard got waived, stretched. 5 years of $22.5 million. Luka Doncic got traded for AD and a pick. Okay. So we're done. We're done with saying that's too preposterous. So yeah. Wouldn't that be an amazing, if it's not Cleveland, that might be the most interesting storyline, is him going to New York.
Well, but what he said, I was at that last, I think the last game he played against Dwayne Wade, and it was like, man, finishing up here at Staples Center, it could only be here, the Garden, that our stories could end. Listen, is the story going to end at the Garden? Who knows?
Breaking news, Dan. Mike Brown has been offered the New York Knicks job. The long national nightmare is over. We now have a New York Knicks head coach. First thoughts for me is, glad he got back on his feet. I think he got a raw end of the deal in Sacramento after what he did to revive that team with, I think, kind of an, as you can see now, an awkward fit roster construction in Sabonis is really tough to build a playoff caliber roster and defense around. And now he gets a chance to do work his magic with this New York Knicks roster that evidently James Dolan and Leon Rose, depending on who you believe who is behind this deal to fire Tom Thibodeau, they believe that this was not enough. The Eastern Conference Finals with the Knicks was not enough, and that they have another level that they can get to. And Mike Brown, they feel, after canvassing the entire league of people who were employed, they end up getting maybe the top head coach free agent that was an NBA head coach last year with the Sacramento Kings before being let go 31 games into the season with a 13-18 record. The thing that jumps out to me is why Mike Brown? Well, defense was always Tom Thibodeau's calling card, so it doesn't really make all that much sense, like, from an offensive mind, why you go with Mike Brown, who's traditionally more of a defensive mind, but Sacramento had some awesome offenses there under his helm.
Yeah.
And like you have pointed out to me, the James Borrego piece is really interesting as an offensive lieutenant coordinator for Mike Brown. We'll still see what happens there. But again, like, if we're going to read the tea leaves here, if LeBron was possibly on the market, would he want to play for Tom Thibodeau? I don't know. Would he want to reunite with Mike Brown? The guy who helped him get to the 2007 NBA Finals as a 22-year-old.
Sure.
I don't know whether that changes or moves the needle for LeBron, but I do think that from a coaching standpoint, I think Mike Brown is a little bit more highly regarded among players in terms of guys I would play for. So maybe the Knicks think that Mike Brown is a more player-friendly coach who might be easier on the players, more open-minded about certain things, not as rigid in his rotations. And I'm interested to see how this plays out.
Yeah, I think that if the concerns about where the Knicks were after the Tom Thibodeau era were that it was a level of rigidity in rotation decisions, who you trusted and who you played, and let your overall creativity on the offensive. And the idea of going with, but you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater, right? You don't want to just like completely get rid of a defensive culture and the idea that getting stops is important. You get a guy in Mike Brown who comes from the Greg Popovich coaching tree, who also spent, what was it, like 6 or 7 years under Steve Kerr in Golden State. And there's that meld of there. We are going to be like a, you know, buttoned up, hard line defensive team, but also strength in numbers and a little bit more flexibility, a little bit more fun, like a little bit more looseness in terms of the way we approach things. And I think you're right to point to the fact that he got to Sacramento and like completely re-envisioned what that offense was going to look like and said, I've been given these kind of disparate pieces. How do I make something happen? It's like, it's all dribble handoff and it's all, high speed, high pace, high shooting. And I don't know that anybody necessarily would have expected that that's how Mike Brown would coach offense. And then he got to Sacramento, took the pieces that he had and made something interesting out of it.
Number one
offense in the NBA,
yeah.
And made something really interesting out of it. And then also like got to the seventh game of a playoff series against the Warriors in that first season, needed Steph to go for 50 in game seven to knock them off. They were roughly as good the next season in Sacramento. It's just the West got better around them and they wound up on the short end of the stick. I think 48 wins and 46 wins in his first two full seasons there. He's like never, I think he's once had a full season finishing under 500. He's been all those years in Cleveland. They had the 1 year in with LA where he went 41-25 in that lockout shortened season. He got fired very early the next season and replaced by Mike D'Antoni, had the one kind of like wonky season back in Cleveland when they got after the Kyrie lottery, but then before LeBron comes back, and then two really good seasons in Sacramento. And then things went south in Sacramento and I don't know how much we can blame him for that. All of which is to say, it does not profile as the like slam dunk, no doubt about it. We've leveled up inarguably over what Tom Thibodeau was kind of higher that I think a lot of people were maybe hoping for. If you are going to make the move to move away from Tom Thibodeau, you need to know who you are hiring and it needs to be a clear upgrade in whatever way. This doesn't not necessarily feel like a win the back pages kind of hire, which is, I think, maybe the best argument you can make for the possibility that it is the right kind of move. Because throughout the time that the Knicks have been under Leon Rose's watch, They have not necessarily done a whole lot of win the back page stuff. They've done a lot of brick by brick, bit by bit, build a more competitive, more cohesive, more sensible roster. The idea of we bring in a guy who we know can coach defense, who's also maybe a little bit more willing to use his bench and think a little bit outside the box in terms of the way he approaches things offensively, especially if you are able to bring in an offensive coordinator like Borrego, who has drawn raves for his ability to do that first, you know, in Charlotte when he was there, and then in New Orleans and other outposts that he's been to. It potentially solves the problems that the Knicks saw that they had, and while retaining some of the things that have helped build the Knicks back up. So cautious optimism here. Much more to be revealed. And then, of course, if LeBron comes, it kind of changes everything. So who knows? Who knows where we'll be by this time next week? But for now, the Knicks have a coach. No more openings in the coaching search for the NBA. We move forward through our NBA offseason.
I'm excited for the hourglass emoji from LeBron after this.
Okay, we got to move on to our third little number this week before I lose my mind and explode into 1,000 sparks here. Our third little number is 106.6. That was the Orlando Magic's offensive rating against the West last season, according to NBA Advanced Stats. If it sounds like it's not good, it's because it's not. It was the third worst in the NBA against Western Conference competition, ahead only of the disastrous Charlotte Hornets and Washington Wizards, neither of whom I'm guessing factor into your LeBron trade conversation. I don't think the Magic are going to get there either, but the Magic have made some moves this offseason. They bring in Desmond Bain, you know, big trade on the, before the start of the NBA, before the start of the draft in the offseason. They bring in Tyus Jones as like the kind of table setting, rock solid, high floor, maybe low ceiling, but high floor backup point guard to get them into their offense. They draft a plus shooter in Jace Richardson, son of Jason Richardson. And maybe the most important thing here, the Magic rolled up that bummer of an offensive rating against the West with Paolo Banchero missing 10 of the 30 games they played against Western Conference competition and Jalen Suggs missing 21 of them. We've talked about this before. Injuries were a giant problem for the Magic last season. They only had their main guys together a handful of times. So Franz Wagner, Paolo Banchero, Jalen Suggs healthy. You add Desmond Bane, who averaged like 20 points, 5 rebounds, 4 assists on 600 true shooting against the West during his time in Memphis. Tyus Jones, more shooting, steps forward for Anthony Black, Tristan Da Silva, the other young guys there. I don't know, maybe Jet Howard pops off. Anything could happen. We're through the looking glass. Maybe Jet Howard makes some shots in the regular season. Do you see a healthier Desmond Bane-ified Magic being the kind of like maybe bully that can get the West off the East back a little bit and help narrow that gap?
Look at this BetMGM board here. We got the Thunder at plus 275, the Nuggets, Rockets, Cavs, right? Knicks, and then above the Lakers and the Timberwolves and the Clippers, you got the Magic, okay? The Magic are sitting there at plus 1,200 title odds next season. And so it's not just that, like, they've got a really good roster here, but they have some ability to kind of pivot with a lot of their young talent. If they don't feel like it's working out well, I think plenty of people would be interested in some of the young core that they have there.
Sure.
But man, they needed offense in the worst way, and they got it. Like, Desmond Bane is one of the best, if not the best, from the three-point side of the equation, 3-and-D guy in the league. And I think he fits perfectly with what they're trying to do. And then Jace Richardson might be the best shooter in the draft. He's undersized. But like, when people were looking at the Magic and like, how are you going to get more shooting on the floor? They could do worse than Jace Richardson, who, as a second-gen NBA player, time and time again, we see those guys, those legacy guys, those bloodline guys like a Jalen Brunson. They just outperform at the next level. And so they take a flyer on Jace Richardson. I love that pick. The Magic are going to be fun next year. I hope they stay healthy. They really do need to stay healthy. And Franz Wagner needs to figure out that jump shot. And if they do, if all those stars align, I could see the Orlando Magic. You know, they're not going to, I don't think, going to get the number one seed as long as the Cavs are there, but I could certainly see them getting a number two seed.
Well, you're too modest to do this, so I'm going to plug it for you. You wrote a really good piece about that second generation NBA star, the sons of prospects, kind of sons of NBA players, prospects thing at Yahoo Sports. It's worth reading. You also had a great conversation about it with Bomani Jones on The Right Time with Bomani Jones. Oh. So I encourage people to go check that out. Tom has been a semi-regular contributor there and doing wonderful work with Bomani. So please go check that out. Our fourth and final little number this week, It's the loneliest number. It's also our final little number. That's how many times in the Trae Young era the Hawks have finished 16th or better in defensive efficiency. So not even top half, but just like 16th in a 30-team league. One time. It was 2020-2021, and that's the year they went to the Eastern Conference Finals. We're recording this again pretty early in the day on the third day of free agency, but I think the Hawks are considered like a unanimous victor of free agency thus far, at least on the Eastern Conference side of things. Partially for the draft pick scenario that they got. We talked about this and what was New Orleans thinking and how the Hawks wound up with this like incredibly valuable unprotected 2026 first rounder, but also the talent they added now. They take advantage of the Celtics fire sale. They get Kristaps Porzingis. They take advantage of the Timberwolves needing or trying to find money to bring back Naz Reid and Julius Randle, and they get Nikhil Alexander-Walker. Both of those guys, when they're on the court, and Porzingis obviously health and is a consideration, but when they're on the court, like high-end defensive contributors, Porzingis with his rim protection, Alexander-Walker point of attack on opposing guards, switchability at 6'6", and this was a team that was already 17th in defensive efficiency last year when Jalen Johnson went down. So the end of January, the Hawks, remember, they had that kind of like sneaky run through the NBA Cup, and they were like looking kind of frisky. Jalen Johnson gets hurt. They kind of go in the tank and end up in the play-in as like their ancestral birthright. But they were like right around middle of the pack defensively when one of their best players got hurt. He comes back. You add Porzingis. You add Nikhil Alexander-Walker. You got Onyeka Okongwu up front to go with Porzingis. You've got Zachary Risacher in year two. Dyson Daniels, defensive player of the year finalist, all defensive player on the wing there alongside Alexander, Walker, and Johnson. And now you've surrounded Trae Young with a ton of length, a ton of activity, a ton of defensive talent. And again, we've only seen it once, but the last time that happened in Atlanta, they were two wins away from the finals. So do you think that the offseason champion Hawks stand a chance of carrying that into the regular season against the West and maybe putting themselves in position to make another deep postseason run?
You laid out the roster construction and why this team is so intriguing this upcoming season. I will also, on top of that, point out that they have that pick from New Orleans, like we mentioned there. That is such a goldmine for just upgrading your roster, because I think that is maybe the most valuable 26 pick on the board. Is it's either going to be New Orleans, or they could swap it with the Milwaukee Bucks pick, depending on which one is higher.
Yeah, the better of those two is nuts. It's like the better of those two picks.
Unprotected. Dad, unprotected. It's nuts. It's nuts. So let's say they're coming into the trade deadline and Giannis is not happy about how things are going. Miles Turner experiment is not going well. And he says, you know what? I gave it a good go. It's not working out here in Milwaukee. Gave it a shot. And look, we're 10 games under 500. Milwaukee, they're going to probably call up Atlanta, aren't they? And just say like, hey, we would like that pick back. Things aren't going well for us. What would it take? I think they're in a position of power here because of how valuable that pick is. I feel like they are standing in that Eastern Conference with another big swing at their disposal. So the teams that we've outlined here, the Knicks, the Cavs, and I think to a lesser extent Orlando, but especially Atlanta, they can go big game hunting in ways that could really tilt the scales back in the East favor, whether it's Giannis or whether it's LeBron. So I think Atlanta, already they can make a real challenge to Cleveland at the top of the East, but they also have that pick, and man, that is such a wild card. Like what does Atlanta do with that? They could keep it, certainly, but if they're that close on the precipice of title contention, I feel like they could get a lot of either smaller parts, four quarters instead of going for the dollar, or they could just take a huge big swing on a player.
Well, yeah, and again, I don't know that that's going to mean that they run 25 years worth of victories off. But like, it does feel like, and I mentioned this in our rundown, and we didn't use it as one of the little numbers. There's also like the shoot the moon. What if Philly actually is healthy and gets its team together? Cause like we expected them to be in this conversation heading into last season. And then they just never got healthy, never got their team together. Like there might be a couple of, big hitters in the East that we just don't see coming right now, or that don't appear to be evident right now. I don't know that anybody saw 64 wins for Cleveland last year. Like something like that could be in the offing, whether organically or as you're mentioning, because of trade. I don't know that it's going to close the whole gap, but it might get, if nothing else, make things a little bit more interesting as we get down towards the balance of next season and into the postseason.
That's right. One game at a time to close the gap on 13.
One possession, one game. That's right. You stack them. That's what Mark Daigneault would say. You stack them and you'd squint at them and you'd stack them. You squint and stack. That's how you do it.
That's right. And then also not drink any beer like the rest of OKC in your celebration of stacking all those wins. It's just,
and for that reason, story. Sharks, I'm out.
All right. Those are the little numbers from Dan Devine here on The Big Number. After the break, we're going to talk about Damian Lillard, the shocker that the Milwaukee Bucks have waived Damian Lillard and signed Miles Turner. We're going to go a little bit deeper on that. Dan, we got to turn injuries off, okay? We got to turn injuries off. This league is so driven by player health in ways that I could not have foreseen on Tuesday when we learned that Red Panda suffered an injury while performing at a WNBA game and had to be wheelchaired off of the floor. I'm devastated to learn this news. Like, the NBA has been dealing with a lot of tough injuries. I don't think anything is more devastating than that one.
It's just, you know, it's a performer that has spanned generations of NBA fandom, has performed in every arena across the country, across the you know, international performances for years and years, and is widely beloved. It's already jarring if you are watching it. You're there for a Red Panda performance, and like one of the Bulls doesn't make it. Let alone her, you know, falling and suffering an injury. I know that there have been falls from her unicycle in the past. Broken arms, other issues.
You know, I prefer not to see it. It's out of sight, out of mind. I don't want to believe that such a thing could be possible.
I agree. And we send nothing but our, I don't have any good numbers about it. If we had big numbers about, outside of just like the, you know, our love for Red Panda's on 1000. So we send our best wishes and our to Red Panda and hope for a speedy recovery and that she's, you know, back up on the proverbial horse, or I guess literal unicycle soon.
One of one. That is the big number for Red Panda. She is one of one. Speaking of injuries, we've got Jaren Jackson Jr., who has suffered an injury, turf toe. Same thing we were talking about with Darius Garland. He's out for the next, what it looks like to be 3 months plus, reevaluated. Probably not going to be ready for the start of the season, like his teammate Zach Edey. Bubble Boy. I haven't watched the movie, but I kind of feel like Memphis should do that with their players in the offseason, because that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
I mean, yeah, our pal Jeff Stotts of In Street Clothes has said like the average lost time for NBA cases that need surgery is about 3 months here. You know, you see Blake Griffin's gone through it. Miles Turner's gone through it. So the glass half full side is like those guys came back and played at super high levels after going through this injury. The downside is the Grizzlies just could use some consistent runway of things going normally and staying steady for a few minutes at a time. It would be nice if that happened. Not so much happening right now. And I mean, I guess the silver lining, now that we've gone from the silver lining to gray cloud back to silver lining, like a compliment sandwich, but for silver linings, is that at least Jaren Jackson Jr. got his Supermax out of it before this sort of cropped up and became a problem. But yeah, come on. Like Memphis, perpetually almost there, and then
I know they are they're helping that 1,318 number go down, so thanks for tying that in, Jaren Jackson Jr., and maybe tightening the gap on that. Now the Milwaukee Bucks, now that we got those two injuries out of the way, we're going to talk about just what a turn of events that a couple months ago Damian Lillard rushed back after his blood clot to come back to the floor and play and perform. What a gamer to put his body on the line to go play for the Milwaukee Bucks, a team that wasn't high on his list, reportedly. I don't think he was thrilled with landing with the Milwaukee Bucks, but he sucked it up and he was like, you know what? I'm going to go and try to perform the best of my abilities, even though this is not the destination I wanted when I was leaving. And unfortunately, he tears his Achilles, and then the Milwaukee Bucks are like, yeah, we're done. We're done with the Damian Lillard era. He might be happy with this. Like, he's a free agent. He gets his money. There's no buyout situation. And he can turn the page. He can go back home to Portland and kind of be with his family, rehab, sign with whomever he wants. But man, the Milwaukee Bucks. Like, Brian Windhorst said this is like taking out a mortgage on a mortgage to buy a sports car. And that is very apt, I think. Like, he nailed that one. That is an amazing analogy there. So Miles Turner, a lot is resting on his shoulders here. He wanted to do this. He signed the deal, foregoing a contract that was at a lesser number reportedly, although, you know, we'll find out next time there's a press conference, like what Indiana's side of the story is on this and how they somehow let Miles Turner slip through their fingers. The guy was the highest tenured player on the Indiana Pacers. And while he wasn't at his best in the NBA Finals, he won a lot of games this postseason with his play. And now no Tyrese Haliburton, no Miles Turner. And I think the Indiana Pacers fans got to look at this roster and say, like, who's next? What's next? Because this is crazy. So Milwaukee Bucks, is it like a sideways move? I don't even think it's a sideways move because they have no Damian Lillard at the start of last season compared to now. I think they're a worse team. So I have a hard time putting them in that tier of teams that could win the East next season. But did they have a choice?
I mean, I think that I wrote about this a little bit at Yahoo Sports in the wake of the injury and the way the Dame news and the like, first in the wake of the injury where it's like they're just out of outs. Like, they don't have pathways to rebuild a competitive title contending roster. If there's no Dame and you've already spent like most of your draft capital trying to make win now trades and Chris Middleton went out and Kyle Kuzma came back in and you're like paying $135 million to Kuzma, Giannis, and Dame, and Dame's not going to play next year. Like, so you need to find a very creative solution to add more talent now, or contemplate the, you know, uncontemplatable of moving on from Giannis.
And, okay, Josh Kroenke. Okay. Yeah,
and so they chose not to do that. And they found a creative solution that is going to put a $22.5 million dead cap charge on their books for the next half decade, which is going to make building like extraordinarily difficult to manage, you know, as you move forward. But what you have is it's Turner roughly replicating the stretch and rim protection of Brook Lopez, right? But in a younger package and for the next 4 years. You have,
Kuzma, Gary Trent Jr., Kevin Porter Jr., AJ Green, Derry Bird, as they like to call him. Mm-hmm.
Gary Harris coming in, you know, like the Falcon out of the portal and event end game on your left. Gary Harris flies in.
As our friend Trey Kirby said, they've got all the Garys in the NBA.
That's true. You've cornered the market on Garys, and you can't put a price tag on that. It's not an overwhelming roster, I would think it's fair to say. The best look at it is probably Giannis is your point forward. You have Turner stretching at the five. You've got Kuzma as kind of a combo forward, and then you put two more shooters out there, whether that's Trent and Kevin Porter Jr. or AJ Green or whatever, but like Harris in some capacity. But that's, you play big, you play physical, you play through Giannis as the point forward, and you hope that there's enough shooting there and that Turner can cover up enough messes defensively and Giannis with his weak side rim protection to be able to be at least roughly commensurate with what you were last season. And the part you have to like really, it's like all in the eye of the beholder is if you look at, I mean, and if Giannis is able to look at that and say, the East is bad enough that if you get me to the playoffs with that, I can win. Like, I'm good enough to get us there. Maybe.
Can they get to the playoffs?
That's a great question.
If they're the seventh seed in the East, they could miss the playoffs in the play-in tournament. Like,
totally. And the only way it really makes sense is you have two guaranteed seasons of Giannis left. He has a player option, I think like 62 and change for the 27-28 season. So you got 25-26 and 26-27 that you know for sure you got Giannis. There is no future for the Milwaukee Bucks if Giannis leaves. So every time they've come to one of these impasses and these forks in the road, they've made a huge move to try to make sure they know, or that he knows, that they are trying to compete for everything they can while they have him. The first one worked out great, Drew Holiday. Second one, Damian Lillard, didn't work out so hot. Now, here we are. If it makes Giannis feel like they're doing everything they can, it's the only move to make until you run out of outs. And they might, that wall feels like it's encroaching and coming forward very, very quickly. But if it makes Giannis feel like we're going to get to the springtime and I'm going to have meaningful games to play and I'm going to have an opportunity, then it's the move that they had to make.
In the chess, I played chess with my 8-year-old, and she beat me the other day, and it was like, man, this is devastating. But the way that she did it was just crushing. You know when you can take your pawn and you go to the other side and you exchange it for your queen, you know? I went to the other side and exchanged it for my queen, and then she killed me, like, as soon as I got it. That's what I feel like the Bucks just did with Miles Turner, which is like, they did get Miles Turner, but what did it accomplish in the Eastern Conference with all the decimation at the top of the East? Of course, you're going to be looking at that and saying, like, okay, maybe we can make a run. But the fact that Indiana let him walk, when something like this happens where they're not willing to go an extra year or add a couple million dollars to the number on an annual contract, and they decide, hey, this has been great, but best of luck to you going forward. There's an asymmetry of information here. Like, the Indiana Pacers have had Miles Turner on their team. The only thing I can think of is that they're worried about his long-term health or something, that they're just like, it's a lot of miles on his tires, no pun intended. It was a long postseason run, and you know what? At that number, we're just going to balk. We're going to let you go. That's the only thing I can think of why they weren't willing to go there. You just went to the NBA Finals. He just played his heart out for the city, and then you're not willing to go the extra number to bring him back. And the tax, like, whatever. Like, if you're not willing to go to the tax to retain a guy like Miles Turner and try to run it back with this group that went to the Eastern Conference Finals last year and then went to the finals this past year, it's a baffling move. So in all respects, like, what a crazy, crazy turn of events.
I think that the argument, the more, I guess, like, friendlier argument for the Pacers, the glass half full look there of, like, why would they do this? The more charitable reading, that's the word of the phrase I'm looking for. Also not sleeping great. Also sports analytics conference, coffee mug, is that, yes, they've made those runs to the conference finals and to the finals with Miles Turner as the five. They made them with him as the five and Tyrese Halliburton as their point guard. And I think they were looking at it and saying, if Tyrese Halliburton isn't the point guard, the guy who is, like, demanding the defensive attention, bending the defense, making the kind of plays that only two or three other players in the NBA can make to create openings for our stretch five, who can't really create for himself and who benefits largely from being able to plan up at the top of the floor in the pick and pop and get spoon-fed open looks, is Miles Turner's value going to look a hell of a lot worse next year with 3 years left or two or 3 years left on a market rate contract that we can't then get value out of? Is he going to be, you know, when Tyrese Halliburton is ready to come back in 2 years, is the 31-year-old version of Miles Turner with two more years to tread on his tires as valuable a player and as much of an elevator for our team as he was these past couple of years? And if we have any questions about that, and if we're unsure about whether that's going to be the answer to those things is going to be yes, then is this a chance for us to kind of treat our crisis as an opportunity and say, we don't get locked into long-term money we're not sure about. We present ourselves with some options to find whatever the next answer is at the five to bring us through the balance of Tyrese Halliburton's prime when he comes back at 27 off the Achilles. And we have the rest of this 25 and under-ish roster where you've got Nembhard, you've got Nesmith, you've got Obi Toppin if he sticks around, you've got Benedict Mathurin, obviously some decisions to be made about him, I think in restricted free agency moving forward. You've got this sort of younger core that Turner is a few years older than and, like, maybe not quite in line with. I think that's interesting. The idea of they're looking at it, you mentioned the asymmetry of information. It may be the information that they feel they have, and that front office maybe deserves the benefit of the doubt given how they've built from the middle and built a title contender out of it, and saying, we think maybe we can't do better right now, but we think we might give ourselves some outs and some opportunities moving forward here. So it hurts now. It does feel like penny, you know, maybe penny wise, but pound foolish. And maybe in 2 years, there's a vision that comes into further view that makes it a little bit clearer why they made that choice.
All right, so that's a wrap. We'll see, Dan. By the time this gets out, maybe Giannis has already made a trade demand. So we'll see. We'll see.
In which case, I'll talk to you in a few minutes. I don't know. We'll find out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. I know everyone with bated breath is going to be tracking the 1,318 number for next season as we see some interconference play. It's going to be great. It's going to be a great summer league. It's going to be great off season. We'll see what happens with LeBron and Giannis and all the other potential goings on in the league going forward. But we've gotten through basically the majority of free agency. We did it, Dan. And yeah, I feel like we're on the precipice of the last day of school or something here. So this is great.
Oh man, don't you put that evil on. Listen, you say that. Everyone, you cross their fingers, throw some salt over your shoulder, you know, whatever your superstition of choice. I don't know. But yes, it does feel like we might be coming in for a landing, which we'll is see. To say, I'll see you in a few minutes when the next batch thing happens. I don't know.
Hourglass emoji. Thanks to Brett. Brett, great to have you on the squad today. The big squad working behind the scenes to make this happen. One of one, Red Panda and Brett Rader. Thank you to everyone behind the scenes for making this podcast a reality. Please watch The Big Number on YouTube. Rate 5 stars wherever you listen to this on your podcast. Go tell your friends. Go watch it and subscribe. Smash that subscribe button. And we will see you next time here on The Big Number. Until then, be safe and enjoy the summer.